Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. What is the price of passion? What is the power of love? Meet Martha Beck, a young nurse dedicated to healing others, until her own hurting heart lured her down a darker path. Loneliness led her to Raymond Fernandez, but love led her all the way to the electric chair. This is the tragic story of the Lonely Hearts Killers. The book that we're featuring this evening is Tortured with Love, the true crime romance of the Lonely Hearts Killers, with my special guest journalist and author, J.T. Hunter. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, J.T. Hunter.
Thanks. Glad to be back on here with you on True Murder.
Thank you very much. Nice to have you back. Incredible story you've brought to us once again, Tortured with Love. As you write in the book, in the mid-40s in America, as a product of byproduct of World War II, many lonely women. There were, in fact, 1 million more women than men in America at that time. And you take us right away to a woman named Martha Beck, who's 27 years old in 1947. Her friend Elizabeth Swanson, fellow nurses at the Crippled Children's Home, they are having a little visit. And Martha's looking through her mail, and they're having a conversation. Take us to this incredible scene where she first meets Mr. Fernandez.
Martha Beck, as you said, her friend had signed her up for what was called the Lonely Hearts Club. And just by way of a little background on that, what these Lonely Hearts Clubs were is they were the equivalent of maybe an online dating service today that we have, where you know, people could meet other people across the country. And the way this worked back at the time this happened, of course, this is before internet and computers and all that stuff. So at the time back then, they had these clubs throughout the country. And the way it worked is the people would join the club. And when you join the club, after you paid your fee, you got a listing of other club members around the country, names and contact information. And then what would happen is the people would write to people they were interested in trying to make a connection to. And, you know, oftentimes they would end up exchanging correspondence over an extended period of time, you know, in the hopes of some sort of romantic relationship developing. So that's kind of the backdrop to what happened with Martha Beck. Her good friend had signed her up for one of these Lonely Hearts Clubs without her knowing it. And so one day they were together at work, as you said, at the hospital, the place they worked there, the medical facility. And Martha got a letter that she didn't recognize. And it turns out it's from one of these Lonely Hearts Clubs. And, you know, she was pretty surprised at first. And when she found out her friend had signed it up for her, she was kind of irritated, but also intrigued. And she eventually signed up for it to get more information. And she was ultimately contacted by someone through the club, this Raymond Fernandez. And they did end up meeting after exchanging letters over, you know, several months' time period.
What kind of information were the women and the men, but especially in the case of Raymond Fernandez's case, what kind of information, personal and otherwise, was included in that posting?
The listings would typically include the name, obviously, and the address or location of the person, but it would also include personal information such as, you know, their hobbies, their interests, and also, you know, financial information in many of the circumstances. And that's how Raymond Fernandez really started using these, is he, you know, he would target women who divulged financial information on their club information sheets that seemed like they would be a promising target in order to try to, you know, get their money out of them. So oftentimes they would have, you know, their net worth or the home they owned or the value of it, that sort of thing. So there was a lot of personal information oftentimes on these listings.
Now you take us to Raymond Martinez Fernandez, born in 1914 in Honolulu, Hawaii. His father had emigrated from Spain, but he had moved the family to Bridgeport, Connecticut for work. He was a harsh disciplinarian, but tell us a little bit about his life and his relationship with his father. And before we talk about what he did at 17 and his move with his mother.
Well, as you said, his father was pretty strict, pretty harsh, pretty hard on him growing up. After they moved over to Connecticut, Raymond spent most of his childhood there growing up and going to school. When he graduated from grammar school, instead of moving on to high school with all his friends, his father forced him to get out of school and help work on the family farm, and was very strict with him in other ways as well, and seemed disappointed in Raymond's physical stature. He wasn't a real big guy, and his father didn't look too kindly on that. So it kind of gave him a hard time in general, and he was just a harsh disciplinarian in general. And you know, there's one little story that was related about when Raymond was about, oh, I don't know, maybe 13 or so, he had come to his father and asked if they could have a traditional Thanksgiving, you know, like a kind of like a normal American family would do, and his father refused outright. He told him, you know, if you want to do something like that, then you need to take care of it. You need to handle it. You know, a day or so after that, Ray got with a couple of his friends, and they went and stole some chickens from a nearby chicken farm, and they got caught. And instead of his father coming and helping him bail him out and bringing him home, like the two friends, both their parents came and got him. Ray's father, you know, refused to take custody of him, and instead he forced him to go face the criminal justice system. And so he was found guilty, stood trial, found guilty at a juvenile facility there, and ended up spending 60 days in county jail there. Kind of an example of, you know, how harsh his father was on him.
Now, his mother, he must have had a different relationship with her. He believed he would have a different life in Spain. So at 17, he moved to Spain with his mother, Frances Morales, and his father stayed behind. And there he met a beauty at 20 years old, Encarnacion, probably mispronounced that, Robles. Tell us about this marriage and what happened in terms of his luck in turning around again for the worse with the Spanish Civil War.
Shortly after he was married, I guess it was about a, you know, less than a year later, he and his new wife, they had their first child. They had a son, was born. And a few months after that, Ray was heading back to the U.S. for work, got a job in New York working as a landscaper. But he received notification from his wife that his son was real sick. So he kind of dropped everything and rushed back to Spain because it looked like his son might die. He got back to Spain and fortunately his son recovered. But while he was back over there, as you mentioned, the Spanish Civil War broke out. So that was in 1936. And because of that, there were no ships, you know, allowed to go out of Spain back to the U.S. So he was basically trapped there with his family in Spain. And he ended up fighting for one of the sides in the Spanish Civil War for Franco's forces. He was forced to serve the front lines there. He did that for 8 months and encountered a lot of, you know, really horrific conditions, as, you know, as you might imagine, in wartime. Saw a lot of bad things, saw a lot of death and destruction, including the deaths and of, you know, his friends and other people he knew. And he described that later on about what the conditions were like and, you know, the rotting corpses on the battlefields and these sorts of things. So it was certainly something that would have left a lasting impression on him.
You talk about he was assigned to be a guard in an infamous prison where they executed Republican loyalist prisoners by firing squad. And you talked about the ditches that these bodies were thrown in, and he assisted with all of this gory work. And like you say, it was not unusual for Ray to send people he knew to their deaths, even friends and neighbors. One time, he wasn't able to maintain his composure, you write, though, and a commanding officer at an execution noticed him crying, of all things. He was so disgusted that he ordered Ray be tied up with the other prisoners and taken to the remote field for execution. Tell us what happens at the last minute, and surely must have had a hand in shaping some of his character.
So he was taken with the other prisoners that were slated to be executed. He was taken to this remote location, you know, and there's this huge, you know, ditch, for lack of a better term there, that they're all forced to stand in, and then they would be shot while they're standing down in the ditch and then buried there. And so he was forced with the other prisoners there to stand down in that ditch, and the firing squad, the execution squad, whatever you want to call it, came and got in position, and, you know, it was the ready aim, and right before the fire command was given, the officer stopped the execution and pulled Ray back out, and then he was, you know, forced to stand there and watch as the execution continued. So the people that he had just been standing next to were all shot and killed in front of him. So yeah, as you alluded to there, again, another certainly traumatic episode during the war that would seem to have some sort of impact on him.
Now, eventually that was the end of the war, and he worked at these dockyards run by the British government, but didn't last long. So September of 1939, Germany's invasion of Poland marked the beginning of World War II. And Ray contacted British officials to offer his services. So tell us a little bit about his service and the kinds of things he did do and experience.
So he, when World War II broke out, he volunteered for this to work with the British there in Gibraltar. And basically what he did is he served as a spy, carrying documents back and forth, confidential documents back and forth for the sides. And by all accounts, he served very, very bravely and took on a lot of dangerous missions during the time.
In 1945, after being in two wars in less than a decade, he secured passage on an oil tanker, which he thought was heading ultimately to New York. He planned to earn money and send for his wife and daughter. There was a storm at sea. What happened at sea? What happened to Ray?
This is, I think, a really important part of his background. You know, we talked about the war and the experiences in those two wars certainly affecting him. But this this circumstance on the ship, this oil tanker, is something that I think really had a huge impact on him. And there was a storm at sea, a really bad storm at sea, and the ship started taking on water because of the waves that were breaking over the deck and things. And the water pumps failed, sure enough, on the ship. So everyone's running around trying to get the thing under control. So Ray, he's trying to help out as well. So he goes down into the pump room to help out, and he's standing down there in the corridor, basically. And a big wave slams into the side of the ship and knocks this huge heavy door, this heavy metal door, off of its hinges. So it falls down this corridor onto Ray, who's standing down below it. So it's a 6-foot high door, about a half inch thick steel door, falls down on him, hits him in the head with such force that that it reportedly left this like indentation in his skull, on his forehead, and left him with a really nasty scar over 3 inches long afterwards as well, and sent him to the hospital. He was hospitalized for weeks and weeks and weeks recovering from that injury.
When you said when he was well enough, he took a job as a utility guy in another oil tanker bound for Liverpool before going to Mobile, Alabama. He was caught stealing some sheets and towels and arrested. He had gotten some advice. What was the advice, and what happened as a result of stealing supplies worth about $53?
Yeah, so after he spent about 4 weeks in the hospital. After he got released from the hospital, he took a job on another ship, another oil tanker. When it arrived in the U.S. in Alabama, he decided to stay on board to earn some extra pay. So he decided to stay on board for a couple weeks to help, get everything taken care of after they had arrived there. When he was getting ready to head out, he was packing up. He noticed some of the other guys that had stayed on were taking different things like towels and bed sheets and whatever else, and sticking them in with their stuff and taking them. So he saw that and he figured, well, they're doing it, I may as well do it as well. So he took some things, and sure enough, he got caught when he was trying to go through customs with these government-owned supplies. And he was arrested. He was given this advice to plead guilty to it, to get a lesser sentence. So he decided to do that, thinking he would get some kind of minimal sentence. But he entered the guilty plea and ended up getting a year sentence. Actually a year and a day imprisonment. And he was sent to a federal prison in the Panhandle, Florida Panhandle in Tallahassee.
Now at this, in his mind, this is a fortuitous event in that he develops a friendship with a cellmate, a Haitian man who practiced voodoo. And there Ray got a copy of a book that was a big influence on him, The Magic Island by William Seabrook, a classic account of voodoo in Haiti. Tell us more about his fascination and what this cellmate had told him about voodoo and what he started practicing even while he was in prison.
He became friends with this cellmate who was heavily involved in practicing voodoo and introduced him to it. And yeah, Ray, he developed this fascination with it. Read that book, The Magic Island, very closely, and started getting all the information he could from his friend about voodoo and what was involved with it. And he really started to believe in these sorts of powers that you could get from it, hypnotism and these other sort of black magic powers and influence that you have on people. He really came to believe that he had developed these sort of abilities. And one thing that really cemented this belief in his mind is he wrote to the judge who had sentenced him, requesting a reduced sentence. And sure enough, his sentence was reduced. This request was granted. He was reduced to 6 months. And he also got a reduction for good behavior, apparently. And so he was released early from the federal prison. And so in his mind, this really confirmed that his voodoo powers were the ones that had caused the judge to reduce his sentence.
Right. Now he gets a job, and one evening after work, he sees a copy of Women's Home Housekeeper, and he was flipping through. and he found an ad. What was the ad that he found, and what was the information that intrigued him?
It was an ad from one of these Lonely Hearts clubs that we mentioned earlier, and it was called Old Chelsea Station was the name of the club. There were many of these across the country, but this was this particular club. He saw an ad. You know, it said something like contact friends, Lonely Hearts, you know, promising the ability to connect with, you know, various people. He went ahead and wrote in, requested an application, mailed it back in with the fee that was involved with it. And as a result of that, he started, he got the list of the other members and started looking it over for the different women, female members, and started writing to them, picked some out and started writing to them. So he started exchanging letters with different women in different locations in the country that he had met through this club. And he went on and joined, you know, a few other similar Lonely Hearts clubs as well and did the same thing. And supposedly he ended up getting a list of, you know, hundreds, a couple hundred women through these different clubs that he was potentially targeting.
Now, you talked that the letter writing skills that he had developed somehow bore fruit. And so he had letters written back to him from three separate clubs, as you write, but he had women write in droves. Some of these women that he contacted, what was the first person that he we talk about correspondence with Jane Wilson Thompson. Tell us about that correspondence.
So he met Jane early on. This is one of the first women he seriously started corresponding with. He was about a month or so after he started joining the clubs when he started corresponding with her. And he ended up meeting her in person. She was a 40-year-old woman living in New York. So, you know, close by. And he ended up meeting her. And they hit it off pretty well and actually made plans to go back to Spain, the two of them. And purportedly on the voyage back to Spain, they were kind of holding themselves out as husband and wife. And Jane was apparently paying for everything as well on the trip too. So they headed over to Spain and got back in Granada, and Ray's wife was there still, you know, still living there with his children. He had four children in total now by this time with his wife. So she was still living there with the children. And they actually, Ray and Jane actually ended up meeting her while they were there. And what ended up happening is one night shortly thereafter, Ray was seen leaving the hotel that he was staying at with Jane, leaving the hotel there. And when he returned the next morning, he discovered Jane dead in the room, was his story anyway. And it turned out the authorities looking into it a little bit more later on, it turned out that it appeared that Ray had poisoned Jane, given her an overdose of some medication she was taking. And by that time, he was long gone. He had left and was headed back to the U.S. So, but this was the first indication of something not right with the women he was meeting through these Lonely Hearts clubs.
There was you say Spanish authorities issued a warrant for Ray's arrest after this, but you say he was long gone. November 29th, Ray sailed for New York, arrived December 8th. And then he had to break the news of Jane's death to her mother, Pearl. What did he say, and what did he say as an explanation, and what did he produce, supposedly, from Pearl's daughter?
He told Pearl that Jane had died of, I believe it was some sort of heart condition while she was over there. He produced this will, this document, was what he said was a will that Jane had prepared, you know, conveniently enough before her death. And in the will, she had given her apartment that her mother Pearl was living in, she had given that to Ray. And so Ray now had control of the apartment and all the furnishings in the apartment.
Now, on this list of priorities, he wants to get back to correspondence and meeting Martha Beck. They have corresponded. So now it's one of the top of the list of women to meet. And there, a few days before Christmas, he telegrammed Martha proclaiming that he just couldn't bear waiting any longer to see her. So you describe their meeting, Ray, 5'8", 160 pounds, and a movie called The Gaslight with Charles Boyer. So for Martha, you have this scene where Ray gets off at the train station and she meets him. Tell us about that.
So as you said, this is a few days before Christmas, 1947. Martha went to the Pensacola train station to meet Ray for the first time in person. And she was a big fan of Charles Boyer. She had seen a lot of his films, including Gaslight, and she was really attracted to him. And so Ray, by all accounts, had a really strong resemblance to this famous actor. His face looked very similar. He had the same sort of deep-set eyes, the same sort of complexion, the same sort of hair, and also the same sort of physical stature. And even the way he kind of walked and moved around was very similar as well. So when he got off the train, it really struck Martha. You know, she was pretty much love struck as soon as she saw him when he stepped off the train. You know, to her, it was like this famous actor that she loved so much had literally just stepped off the train into her life.
She had two children. What was his attitude towards the children?
She was really happy to see that that Ray really seemed to enjoy the children and like the children. You know, he stayed with her there in Pensacola for a few days, and while he was there, he spent time with the kids and was, you know, seemed to show an active interest in them and seemed to really have a genuine affection for them. So that really helped in her mind firm up that you know, he was the right guy for her.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
What kind of talk ensued quickly as a result of a couple days of being together?
This was the first time, of course, that Ray had seen Martha in person. And just to kind of step back a little bit, Martha was a larger woman. She was pretty big. She's certainly not like some petite little lady, you know, that he might have in mind. So when he saw her in person, it was no doubt a little bit of a surprise to him. So he, you know, he decided that he didn't want to have too much to do with her. So after a few days, he told her, he made up a story essentially that he needed to be back in New York to take care of some kind of business matter. He had to leave right away. So he, you know, he did that, and it was very upsetting for Martha. You know, she really wanted to be with him longer, and she didn't react too well to it when he left. But he did end up heading back up to New York, and you know, it turned out she ended up following him up there. Not much longer after that, she showed up in New York unannounced, surprising him, and he wasn't too keen about that.
Well, she had brought her two children as well, so he really wasn't too happy with that. What did he say to her? And this is right around Christmas.
He told her he eventually decided, you know, she could stay with him, but the children wouldn't be able to stay. And she thought about it and weighed it in her mind, and she decided the future that she thought she might be able to have with Ray, she decided was worth more than her two children. So she ended up taking her two kids to a Salvation Army location there and pretending like they were going to be spending the night there. And then, you know, she waited until her son fell asleep, and then she told her daughter she was stepping out to get something for them, and said she would be back. And she walked out and never came back and abandoned her kids for Ray.
You talk about the next few weeks. She is deliriously happy, going to movies, dancing, dinner, sightseeing. And he waits on her hand and foot, and she'd never had any kind of treatment like this before. Very lovable, always caressing her. So what happens with this confidence in this relationship? He decides to do what and tell her what?
So eventually he decides to confide in her about what he's doing with these Lonely Hearts Clubs. You know, he lets her in on the secret that he's targeting women purposely in order to you know, scam them out of their money, you know, to fleece them out of whatever they have. So he lets her know that. He must have sensed how devoted Martha already was to him, you know, in this short time period, and for him to divulge that. So he told her that, and, you know, it didn't really seem to faze her too much. You know, she didn't go running off and say, "I don't want to have anything to do with you." They got quite the opposite. You know, she stayed with him, and she ended up helping him out with these scams and started posing as his sister when he would meet these other women.
It's a little more complicated than that, because she says, "Listen, I love you no matter what. I don't know if you can love another woman, but I'm going to be with you no matter what. I don't care about these other fake romances. This love is so genuine, I don't care." And then he gives her ultimatums, and he says, "Listen, but the thing is, you can't interfere. I'm going to do whatever I want to do. I'm going to do whatever I want to do." And, of course, she agrees with that, doesn't she?
Exactly. He does. He does give this ultimatum that he's going to allow her to stay with him. But yeah, this condition that she can't interfere with what he wants to do. So, and she's so taken with him that she agrees to it. She's fine with that condition.
Now, on February 13th, Ray sets his plans into motion. He needs to go to Reading, Pennsylvania to meet Esther Henne, and she was instantly attracted by his genteel manner and bad boy attitude. What were they talking about after a couple days being together?
Well, after he met Esther, you know, not long after that, the idea of marriage, you know, this is kind of Ray's MO. He would start bridging the idea of getting married, you know, in order to lead the woman on and let her think that he was really serious about this relationship, you know, in order to get her, put her guard down and, you know, trust in him and all these sorts of things. So it was the way he operated these scams is he would do this. And so, yeah, so with Esther, he brought up the idea of marriage. And so there were plans made for them to be married. And sure enough, they drove to the courthouse and had a marriage ceremony.
Now, this is their first endeavor together. So right away, Esther realizes that Martha had taken some of her jewelry. And then she finds a money belt with $500 missing. Tell us a little bit about this. Despite his charm and his explanations, this woman is seeing some things that concern her.
So so this money belt goes missing with $500 in it, which, you know, back in 48, $500 was, I mean, it's a lot today, but it was really a lot back then. So this goes missing, and Esther started getting a little suspicious about things that were going on. She started having some second thoughts, and she kind of gave Martha the slip when they were supposed to be going to the bank, and went back to the apartment, hopped in her car, and drove back home to Pennsylvania. So she, you know, she was pretty fortunate to have these suspicions come up and be able to get away like that, because she'd hung around, she might have suffered the fate that some of these other women ended up suffering.
Now, Ray is spooked by Esther's getaway, and so he sold the Jane Thompson apartment that he had chiseled out of her through the will. And he had pocketed $1,500 from that sale. Now, you say he's empowered by this cash, and so he goes on a trip, takes Martha on a trip, and then they decide to relocate to Chicago. He gets a job as a mechanic, and she gets a job as a nurse. Now, what happens when almost all that money is gone from that apartment sale? What does Ray do? As you say, who does he meet through the Lonely Hearts Club this time?
So he goes back to the Lonely Hearts Club and picks out another woman there that he's been corresponding with. Her name's Myrtle Young. She's a 40-year-old woman from Arkansas. And he ends up pursuing her through the Lonely Hearts Club. And, of course, they end up meeting. She takes a bus to Chicago to meet him. And Ray introduces Martha again as his sister. Sure enough, not long after that, a few days later, Ray is marrying Myrtle Young. So they get married there in Chicago, and through that, Ray ends up getting more money. Gets money from Myrtle, gets her to wire money from her bank in Arkansas to the bank there in Chicago, and withdraw the money, and buys a new car for Ray, and all sorts of good things for him.
Now, Myrtle, though, is not liking the situation with his sister around all the time. So she tries or is planning to get rid of Martha. Ray and Martha have a conversation. And so what is planned and what does Martha do?
So they decide that they need to get rid of Myrtle. So Martha gives her an overdose of barbiturates, and Myrtle loses consciousness, and what they do is they end up sticking her on a bus bound back for Arkansas. You know, they keep the car that she had purchased for Ray. They keep the thousands of dollars she'd withdrawn from her bank, and send her off on the bus. And she's found on the bus a day or two later, you know, dazed, barely coherent, has to be carried off the bus, and ends up dying not long after that in a hospital there in Arkansas without ever really giving a real coherent account of what had happened to her. So
yes.
another victim of Ray's Lonely Hearts Club scandals here.
You say all the while, too, he has been sending money to his family in Spain, his wife and his four children. And they have a comfortable life.
He's been sending money back to Spain to help support the family, you know, using part of the monies he's getting from these victims that he's targeting through these Lonely Hearts Clubs to support his wife and kids back there in Spain. You know, it's a repeating pattern. So after they get rid of Myrtle, then he goes back and finds another one. So this time he finds a woman in Vermont that he takes a liking to. Irene de la Pointe. So once again, he goes and meets her. Again, Martha's posing as his sister. They go to Vermont to meet her, and he uses the same name he's been using. He goes by Charles Martin instead of using his real name when he meets these women. And again, the subject of marriage comes up when he meets her. They even get blood tests there in Vermont. You know, something happens this time before they can get married. Martha finds out that they're making these wedding plans again. And you know, throughout her time with him, when he's meeting these women, Martha's been battling to keep her jealousy in check.
Right.
She has to stand by and watch him marrying these women. Oftentimes serving as the, an official witness for it. And she's been having a problem with it, and it's been boiling up. And by this time it kind of boils over. And what she does is she ends up writing a letter to this latest woman, Irene, and tells her point blank what Ray's been doing. Leaving out the fact that he's killing the other women, but letting her know that bad things have happened to these other women he's met through the Lonely Hearts Clubs. And so, of course, Irene reads the letter and calls off their relationship with Ray. And when he finds out why she did so, he's furious with Martha, and so he sends her away. But of course, they get back together. Martha can't bear to be away from him, and to his surprise, I think Ray discovers that he is actually missing Martha too. So he lets her come on back, and they start back up again.
What does she tell him regarding her health, and what does he recommend for her to do, and what does she do?
So she lets him know that she's pregnant, and he tells her, basically just tells her that she needs to get an abortion. He doesn't want to have the child, so she ends up doing the procedure herself. She takes a needle, a large like crochet needle, and performs this procedure on herself by inserting that up into her vagina in order to puncture the sac up in her vagina, in her uterus. And she does this, and she ends up giving birth to the baby. I think it was a few days later when actually the miscarriage happens. She does that at a house she's working at as kind of a caretaker for the kids that live there. She ends up giving birth when no one's at the house. She's alone, and gets rid of the baby that's born. And so that takes care of the abortion that Ray wanted.
So they're back together, and Ray is employing his voodoo powers of deviation, divination, and he finds a person named Janet Faye, 5'4", 135 pounds, with what's most important to him when he looks at these women that he picks out, that she has $7,000 in savings. So what happens with Janet Faye as Charles Martin?
So this is about a year after Ray and Martha had met. This is December of 1948. And he targets Janet Faye. She was a widow. Her husband had died a year or two earlier. And she was a very religious woman. She was a Catholic. And so he kind of played up on his Catholic background and made it, seem like that he was very active in the church. And she really liked that. So he ended up driving over to meet Janet. She was from Albany, New York. And again, the same sort of thing. Martha's my sister. I'm Charles, and all this sort of thing, the same sort of scam they use to get in with Janet. And of course, again, marriage is brought up, and Janet is certainly game for that. She's very attracted to Ray, and they continue down this path. And as you said, she had quite a bit of money saved up, so that really attracted him to her as well. And he ended up getting a lot of that money. He ended up getting her to go to these various banks where she maintained her accounts and withdrawing the funds, and either in cash or in cashier checks. And she ended up handing that over to him to keep for safekeeping, basically.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Now, the thing is, she had put on her profile that she was 44, but in actuality, she was like 66. So, again, he had to make a little bit of an adjustment, I would think. What does she notice about the relationship between Martha and Ray?
Janet picks up that it seems like that there's a little bit more than a normal brother-sister kind of relationship going on there. I don't know if you ever, you know, put two and two together completely, but something didn't seem quite right to her mind.
Mm-hmm. And one night, because they sleep together, Martha and her, and Ray sleeps in another room. During this time that they spend together, the three of them, they have these late night trysts where they do everything but have sexual relations. Again, unbeknownst to her, that Martha is a seething, jealous wife. So, tell us what happens one night when they're sleeping and she's a little bit restless. What kind of conversation she has with Martha?
So Janet, one night when they're sleeping there, she really starts to get concerned about the money that she's taken out of all her bank accounts and that Ray has, and you know, starts peppering Martha with questions about it, and ends up getting up and leaving the bedroom and going out into the living room where Ray's sleeping on the pull-out couch there. And there ends up being a confrontation. And this is really where the story kind of takes different turns, because there ends up being, I think I ended up counting, there's four different versions of what happens next,
right,
depending on who's telling it and depending on when they're telling it, because the story kind of changes at different points.
Sure.
But the end result of it is Janet Fay is murdered in the apartment by being struck in the head with a hammer twice, and also by being strangled. So, you know, who did it and what exactly the circumstances were of how it occurred, you can't say with 100% certainty. The only thing you can say for sure is that Ray and Martha were both there, and Janet was murdered. In the kind of the first, one of the first accounts of it is that Ray, you know, upon hearing Janet, you know, going on and on about her worries about the money and these sorts of things, that he kind of motions to Martha to a hammer that he had got out earlier that night, indicating to her that, you know, she needs to get rid of Janet. And, you know, tells her, you know, if you love me, you'll do it. And so Martha takes the hammer and, you know, whacks Janet across the head. And then they end up, you know, making sure she's dead for sure. And then there's a period of time afterwards where they're trying to cover up the crime. This is all covered in the book, where they're trying to figure out how they're going to get rid of the body. They're going to different banks trying to collect these cashier checks to get all of the cash that Janet had, and eventually do end up getting rid of the body. They find a house, a rental house, that has a basement that allows them access to the open ground in the basement. So they dig a hole in the basement, they dig a grave in the basement for Janet, and throw her in the hole. You know, fill it back up with the dirt, and then Ray covers it over with cement, and allows the cement to harden there in the house. So that's how they get rid of Janet after they kill her. And then it's right back to what they were doing before. They go back to the list, the Lonely Hearts list, and they find somebody else. So this time, a woman named Delphine Downing, who's another widow from Michigan.
Yes, and she has a 2-year-old as well, and Ray's letters are very, very effective, again, doing things very, very quickly so that now he only has to send a few letters and these people are overcome and want to meet him. The three of them get together in February and have a couple weeks of sexual relations. When she misses her normal menstrual cycle, who does she come and who does she ask for advice? And what is that advice?
So Delphine, she's concerned that she might be pregnant. So she goes to Martha and confides in her and, you know, asks for help. And Martha assures her, I know exactly what to do. I know how to take care of it. So Martha gives her a bunch of sleeping pills and tells her to take them because it'll abort the pregnancy. So Delphine does what's suggested. She takes the pills, becomes, you know, very, very drowsy, obviously, because of that. And the child, Renielle, a 2-year-old, sees her mom acting really weird and so starts crying and all these sorts of things. And as a result of that, Ray ends up going into the next room and getting a gun that belonged to Delphine's, deceased husband, and comes back into the room and shoots Delphine in the head with it, kills her. Now they have another body to get rid of, and now, of course, they have the 2-year-old daughter as well to deal with.
Now they try to do some things like buy her a puppy and try to relate to her and try to win her over. Daughter has some problems, so eventually what do they decide to do with the daughter? And you describe this incredible scene where Ray asks a huge favor of Martha.
At first they think maybe they can, you know, keep the girl, but they ultimately decide there's really no way that's feasible, that it would just be too difficult trying to explain, you know, why she was with them and these sorts of things. So Ray decides they have to get rid of her. And he tells Martha, you know, again, kind of point blank, that that you need to do it. You need to get rid of her. So Martha, you know, what Ray wants, he gets when it comes to Martha. So Martha takes the little girl and takes her downstairs. When they dug the hole to bury the mother, Delphine, as they were digging the hole, the groundwater started filling in the hole. And so they had to take a bucket and bail the water out of the hole as they did that. And so the water had been put in, like a wash tub there in the basement in the cellar. And the water was still there. So she went downstairs with the little girl and grabbed her by the feet and turned her upside down and dunked her in the water and drowned her.
And buried her beside her mother and cemented it over. Now,
very
they went
horrific.
To
go ahead.
They went to see a movie afterwards, but when they returned, they were met at the door by who?
So this is kind of another kooky sort of thing. I mean, they had just recently buried the mother, and they just killed this 2-year-old girl and buried her beside her mother. And what do? They decide they're going to go into town and go to the movies. So they go to the movie. They come back, as you said, and, you know, not more than a minute or so after they walk in the door, there's a knock at the door, and it's the police. So the neighbors had become suspicious about Ray and Martha being there and why Delphine had kind of disappeared without her telling anybody about that. And they didn't believe the stories that Ray and Martha were telling, that Delphine kind of had a family emergency she had to go to and this sort of thing. So they had called up the police and asked essentially that they conduct a welfare check. And so the police showed up at the house there, knocked on the door and kind of asked Ray, you know, where Delphine was. And, you know, he said the same sort of thing, that she had to leave her family emergency and that she took her daughter with her. And that he and Martha were just there kind of house sitting. So the police asked if they could come inside, and he let them in, and you know, obviously feeling confident that they had done a good job disposing of the bodies, but the police did end up in the basement eventually, and they found the bodies. And you know, it was said that Rennell's body was the little girl's body was still warm when they dug her up, because it had been so recently. Of course, Ray and Martha are arrested as soon as they discover this.
Ray has $4,000 in cash on him, and they found the list of over 100 women's names from 12 states on a Lonely Hearts circular, a 17 with check marks, you say likely prospects. Now, also, they found a .22 caliber, and they found in a trunk a bloodied ball-peen hammer. So, obviously, they have these arrests, and there's a DA, Roger McMahon, arrives, and what happens at questioning from both of these people?
So, yeah, he separates Ray and Martha and starts questioning them, and they start, you know, tell them, you know, you guys got me dead to rights. He decides he's just gonna open up and tell them. He says, I'm no average killer. I may as well come clean and tell everything. Almost like he's, you know, in a way, maybe sort of proud of what he's done. But he goes on and tells them what happens. Martha does the same thing. And this is what I kind of talked about earlier, about how there's these different versions of events come out. So we get a version of the story from Martha, where Martha has this confrontation with Janet, and next thing she knows, she has the hammer in her hand and hits her. And then we have a version of the story later on while they're in custody, a kind of a supplemental statement that changes, where it goes back more to Ray, like, directing her to commit this murder, ordering her to commit this murder. And then we get another version of it. At trial, the story changes from both of them. And then even later on, after they've been convicted at trial, the story changes. Ultimately, Martha leaves behind kind of a final confession, which has a different version of the story as well. So while they're in custody, though, they give these different confessions. And meanwhile, the state of New York and the state of Illinois are going back and forth on, you know, who's gonna send in the trial, because Ray confesses to the Janet Faye murder and tells them where to find the body and everything. So New York really wants to put them on trial for murder. And ultimately, that's what ends up happening. They end up getting extradited to New York to face trial. And so that's where their trial is held.
What the public loves most, and today and then at the same time, is true. There was details of as part of the defense that this was abnormal sex between them. And given the time, they talked about oral sex from both partners and those kinds of details. What you describe in the book, how sensational and how big this trial was, and how the crowds had to be controlled. Tell us more about how big a case this was and why.
I mean, the trial had had national coverage, and it was really, I mean, for the time especially, it was really scandalous kind of material when they're going into real details about their sexual lives and their sexual practices. And as you said, they're talking about, you know, the oral sex practices that they're engaging in and things like that. I mean, at the time, that wasn't really something that people talked about for sure publicly, you know. I mean, even now, people don't go around talking about it publicly. So for them to be, you know, testifying about these things in trial, it was very, very attractive as far as people wanting to hear this sort of thing and kind of being fascinated by it. And so the courtroom was packed for the testimony, both when Ray was testifying about it and also when Martha was testifying about it. I mean, they had accounts of people, you know, the crowd spilling over from the courtroom out into the halls and having to be cleared away, and police having to be called from a nearby police branch in order to help get the crowds away. So it was a very very popular trial, very scandalous kind of subject matter going on.
And especially fascinating and interesting to women, wasn't it?
Yeah, a lot of the ones that were really trying to get in there apparently was women who were really interested in this. I mean, it was, you know, as you can imagine, the victims were, of course, women. And, you know, maybe a lot of these women that were wanting to be there to hear about this firsthand and to see these people that had done these things, you know, they probably imagine themselves being victims, perhaps. So there were a lot of the spectators in the courtroom were female, were women.
Now they got themselves lawyers and vigorous defense attitude towards their attorneys. But there was the issue of Michigan having the death penalty and New York not having the death penalty, or vice versa, pardon me. But so there was some bone of contention at the trial that, and it was part of the appeal that, of course, was denied. But the idea that there was a deal offered by the DA in terms of extradition to New York from Michigan. Just tell us about that, because it did have some bearing in these proceedings.
Ray and Martha both insisted that part of the reason why they confessed to the crimes is because they were promised by the prosecutor, by the DA there in Chicago, that if they did so, they would be able to stay there in Illinois and have their trial conducted there. As you said, there was no death penalty there, and that they would not be extradited to New York, where there was the death penalty. So they both insisted that was a key reason why they had confessed.
Now, their behavior at trial, unlike, say, modern day, they were at the same table with the defense attorneys. And so what was their behavior like? What kinds of things and affection towards each other did they exhibit at this trial?
They exhibited a lot of affection for each other, you know, when they could. You know, they obviously exchanged glances and things. But, you know, there's one kind of example would be when Martha was called to testify on her way to the witness stand. She kind of went out of her way to walk over to Ray and give him a kiss before she went up there to take the witness stand. And there were other instances, you know, out in the hallway of the courthouse and things where they would embrace or kiss and, you know, pronounce their love for each other and these sorts of things. So it was certainly something that continued through the trial, and it was something that was played up, you know, the romance between the two of them, you know, and the name that they got, the Lonely Hearts Killers, that's what they were dubbed in the media, one of the names that they used for them. So that was certainly going on. And, you know, you mentioned the fact that they were both at the defense table. And one of the really striking things about the trial for me as an attorney is that they both had the same counsel representing them in the trial.
Right.
So
yeah.
It's something you would not see today, certainly not today, because of the conflict of interest that's going on. I mean, they're both on trial for murder of these women. And yet they have the same attorney representing them. And, you know, that was something that was brought up both during the trial and also on appeal. But strangely enough, this is how it went. So they both had the same attorney there during the proceedings.
And they tried in vain to have this defense of this, I guess, partial amnesia, diagnosed with hysteria amnesiac type. But it was to no avail with the judge and jury. What happened in terms of their conviction, and what was their reaction? Before we talk about post-conviction and their relationship in prison.
They raised Martha in particular. You know, tried to assert that she had an amnesiac event at the time of the killing, and so you know, therefore, because of that, she didn't have the necessary criminal intent to be convicted of first degree murder. But that was not accepted by the jury. They rejected that. Of course, there was expert testimony on both sides about that. But ultimately, they're both convicted for the first degree murder. They didn't have a whole lot of emotion when it was when the verdicts were announced. But they were both sentenced to death. They were both sentenced to serve out their time preceding their execution at Sing Sing Prison, the famous prison there in New York.
Right.
Which was another. Even just another kind of added interesting layer to the case, I thought, the fact that they're the famous prison institution where the use of the electric chair really got its start and was really famous for.
Right. It was interesting, too, that while they were in prison, I just thought it was so strange that, especially given Ray's past, that Ray thought Martha was having an affair with a prison guard. And really was very, very upset about this, wasn't he?
Yeah, he certainly became, and you can say, well, is this something that he was doing, trying to play the system somehow to help with his appeal or something, or was he really under the impression that this was going on? But either way, he asserted that Martha was having an affair with one of the prison guards there, and that, it was basically driving him crazy. He couldn't take it anymore, and he was wanting to drop his appeal so he could be executed sooner and all this kind of stuff. So this did happen. There may have been suspicions between them. They're spending all these, long hours and days and basically isolation there. And so maybe naturally suspicions started rising up in their minds there. But this was kind of an interesting issue that happened while they were in prison. And, the details of it are all included there in the book. But they did eventually kind of reconcile after that, it was all over and done with.
Yeah, it seems incredible that she writes him a letter and basically says that he's a double-crossing, two-timing skunk, and he betrayed himself as a misunderstood boy and in the clutches of a female vampire. So she called herself a gullible fool, and yet their relationship was repaired to this incredible point before their executions. At the same time, what kind of relationship, if any, did he have with or contact with his wife in Spain?
Well, the whole time he was in Sing Sing, he was sending letters back to his wife in Spain, and they were exchanging letters back and forth, very loving letters, both on his part and also on the part of his wife. So he had kept up, apparently he had kept up his feelings, his love for his wife, throughout the time that he also supposedly had this love for Martha as well. So he had basically, two women going on at the same time there. And that's really kind of one of the underlying themes, I think, of the story is, what extent there is of true love and what love can make someone do. Especially in the case of Martha, how much was she manipulated by Ray? How much power did he have over her because of the feeling she had for him? And it was brought up in closing argument by their attorney at the trial. He said that she became so wrapped up in Ray that she was just like another hand to him that he could use to do, whatever he wanted to do. And he kind of talked about how kind of mysterious love can be. No one can really always explain why somebody falls in love for somebody. and that that this kind of unexplainable love that Martha had for Ray had caused her to do these things, and that it had kind of short-circuited or overpowered her ability to reason and think clearly in those sorts of things. And that comes up again shortly before their executions there in Sing Sing in the electric chair. Martha leaves a final statement, a written final statement that's quoted in the book. And she says, "My story is a love story." And she says, "But only those tortured with love can understand what I mean." And of course, that's where the title of the book comes from, Tortured with Love. It really is a great example, I think, of this, this power that love can have over people. And, it's something that happens over and over again. So even though this story, took place a long time ago, primarily in the late 40s, early 50s, it still strongly resonates today because, we can still see this all the time. People in not just maybe your everyday life, you probably see it maybe with people you can't quite understand why somebody's doing something, why they're with a certain person or not, but, you see it throughout history as well. So it's a story that continues all through the ages. It always has been, and, it always will.
Yeah, there's so much that you include about their undying love for each other and passing of the poems, and then her final statement delivered through her attorney Rosenberg, that she said that I had a great love and I always will have. And they talked about, I guess, love everlasting in these letters, and an incredible letter writing campaign between them. She didn't sound like she was naive at all, and that or not intelligent, that she really understood what she had done and what she had. She wrote that the sin is great, but so is the penalty. So she realized what was in store for her, and both of them went to their deaths with, I guess, if anything else, with some dignity in their minds.
Yeah, as you said, they both proclaimed their love for each other to the very end, and they both went to their deaths, happy to the extent that they knew that they had this love for each other, and that perhaps it would continue in the afterlife, but they certainly had this, and it's interesting that after their executions, this would have been, months after their executions, there was the chief psychiatrist for the defense at trial, a guy named Richard Hoffman. He came out with a story. He told the story to a true crime detective magazine, this Untold Story of Martha, where he said that he had, in his time with Martha, that she had given him like a final statement, or like an official final statement of what happened, the count of the crime. And in that, she basically pinned the murder of Janet Faye on Ray, and said that she had been out of the room where Ray and Janet were, and she heard a cry, a yell, a cry out, and she came into the room and saw Ray murdering Janet. And she insisted that she had never hit Janet with a hammer, and that it was all Ray. And according to this Dr. Hoffman, he had taken this account and showed it to Ray, and Ray had confirmed that it was the truth. But he had refused to go on record that it was the truth, basically saying that if he was going to go to the chair, Martha was going to go as well. So, it's kind of left to us to say, well, is that true or not? What's the real truth in the story? And, you'll never really probably know, because the only people that really know what happened was Ray and Martha and Janet Faye. And obviously none of them are around anymore. And you got different stories from Ray and Martha all the time about what happened. So, at the end of the day, what exactly happened is kind of left to the imagination to some extent there.
her in you know, her involvement in terms of totality is in question, and same with Janet Faye. But I think legally, based on accomplice, being an accomplice to other murders and the covering up of murders, that she would be an accomplice. So I think that there may be more to the story, and we'll never know the exact story, but certainly they were, as you write, listed as the number four crime duo in American history. So I think that's is true.
And just, you know, one thing I wanted to point out, too, is, you know, we talked about earlier about this accident that Ray had on the ship where this door hit him in the head. And, you know, nowadays we know that that sort of thing, that sort of traumatic injury to the frontal lobe of the brain can drastically change someone's personality and behavior. And the reports from Ray's family and people who knew him at the time said that, yeah, after this accident happened, he really changed a lot. His behavior changed a lot. He acted like a different person in a lot of ways. And when you look back at kind of what he did after that, he really does display a lot of the characteristics of a psychopath. I mean, he has this lack of responsibility for his actions. He leads this kind of parasitic kind of lifestyle, preying on these vulnerable women. He's prone to these fits of anger, and, you know, he can become suddenly violent and these sorts of things. So he really did sort of change after this accident and really fall into this pattern of this kind of psychopathic personality. And that would really lend itself to, you know, what he did with Martha and kind of the influence he had over her and how he kind of sucked her in into this darkness, you know, basically, because before Martha met Ray, I mean, she didn't have any kind of legal problems. She didn't have any kind of record or anything. So, you know, it looks like that he kind of sucked her into this and drove her to do these things.
He was certainly gained that confidence with his voodoo and what he believed were his successes as a result of that black magic. And I think he had that confidence right to the very end, even believing that he might somehow get out of the bind that he was in, facing execution. I want to thank you very much, JT, for coming on and talking about Tortured with Love, the true crime romance of the Lonely Hearts Killers. It's been a fascinating interview, certainly. For those that might want to take a look at your other work, do you have a website or is there a Facebook page they might take a look at?
Yeah, I have both. I have my website is jthunter.org. I'm also on JT Hunter, true crime author on Facebook. I'm also on Twitter, on other social media, JTH True Crime, as well. So any of those places, please check me out.
Thank you very much, JT. You have a great evening. Thank you for this. Good night.
Thanks, Dan. I enjoyed it. Take care.
Good night.